Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Richard Camp about eTech International, and we're going to be hearing from Open Hands. Right now, I would like to welcome Margaret Brown. She's director of the film The Order of Myths, which opens this Friday, December 12th, at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to KSFR.
Thanks.
So this is a documentary that you made about the annual carnival celebration in Mobile, Alabama. It was shot, I guess, last year. And it's
yes.
a story to which you have family ties.
Right.
Did you grow up going to these carnival celebrations that you document?
Actually, I mostly just went to parades. I didn't really go to the balls. I wasn't old enough to go. But, you know, it's something you do kind of when you're more of an adult. And I moved away when I was 18.
So what made you decide to do this documentary? How did you get interested in the whole politics and culture of these whole Mardi Gras balls and parades and everything that goes on around them?
Well, it was very much in my family. My mother was the white Mardi Gras queen in 1966, and my grandfather, part of the Mardi Gras celebration in Mobile is being a debutante, and my grandfather really wanted me to be a debutante, and I did not want to be a debutante, and I guess I sort of made the film instead, in a way. But yeah, it was just always in my family, and it was just such a, you know, an important thing in Mobile, and I didn't really know what was going to happen the year we were going to film. I just knew after making my first film, which was about Town Sand's aunt who died before I started the film, I really wanted to film something that had a very solid beginning, middle, and end, like, you know, carnival season.
Let's go back historically. This is the oldest carnival in the United States, dating back from to 1703. That's amazing.
Yes.
What do we know about carnival in 1703 and on into the 18th century?
Well, I'm not so much of a historian. It is actually was celebrated as far as I know. Differently at that was sort of more like a big party, but there wasn't, you know, people dressing up as kings and queens, and there weren't like you know, floats that were parading through town, so it was different. But you know, it did start in Mobile, but way before New Orleans. No one really knows that.
And yeah, no, it's amazing. And has there always been a black component to it? I mean, what you show, and we'll get into that in a moment, is the real segregation between the black and the white carnival. Did the black carnival develop after the end of slavery?
Well, there was yes, it was definitely before the end of slavery, and I mean after slavery ended. But the MAMGA, the organization that's in the film, started in the 30s, there was another society called the Order of the Doves that's not been as well documented that was before that. But, you know, sort of the it's pretty recent compared to when the white celebration started. And I believe it sort of began because, you know, they weren't allowed to be in the white celebration.
So let's talk about these two, the black and the white Mardi Gras in Mobile, Alabama. You show their preparations, including incredible costumes that a lot of time and money and effort and just aesthetic acumen is spent on, on both sides. How are these two Mardi Gras, the black and the white expressions, how are they different and how are they similar?
Well, they're similar in that they're both sort of based on a European tradition of royalty. And, you know, I think there's a lot of curiosity in both communities sort of about, like, what the other community is doing. When I started the film, my uncle was just, and this was really amazing to me, he was like, God, I'm glad you're making, you know, a movie about, that's partly about the Black Mardi Gras, because I just have no idea, you know, what they do. I mean, there was a huge amount of curiosity, you know, because it was so separate that there was just like absolute, you know, he was just really curious about what I would find.
So what did you find? I mean, first of all, you had family ties to the white side. How did you get your way into being able to really film and get close to the black side?
Well, I think, I mean, actually, in a weird way, the white side was harder Because I think because it's segregated, and no one really wants to say that out loud, or they claim that it isn't, people were nervous about, or certain people, certainly not everybody, but certain people were very nervous about me filming. So, you know, and I don't think the black side felt like so much they had so much to hide. So it was easier in a certain way. But, you know, really, it was, as I think it always is when you're making a film, it's about hanging out and getting people's trust and, you know, having them realize you're a person and not just a camera. So, and we filmed for 370 hours. So we were around all the time.
Yeah.
And so after a while, people just sort of got used to it. And that's sort of what made them comfortable, I think.
Yeah. There's an amazing event that took place after the slave trade was outlawed. And that was, there was a man in Mobile, Alabama, who made a bet that he could bring in a ship full of slaves. Tell us that story.
Well, the way it relates to the film is that there was a man, Timothy Mayer, who was part of a bet. He was bet that he could bring a ship of slaves to Alabama after slavery was outlawed. This is in 1859. And he won the bet. He brought the slaves to Alabama. And the ship was called the Clotilda. And the queen, the white queen of Mardi Gras last year when I filmed, was Helen Mayer, who was descended from Timothy Mayer. She was, I believe, his great-great-granddaughter. And the thing that we found out as we were filming, actually after Mardi Gras, when we were doing some interviews sort of after Mardi Gras, Stephanie Lucas, who's the black queen, her grandfather, when we were interviewing her grandfather and grandmother and Stephanie, he said in the interview that he was descended from this ship. And my idea for the film kind of going in was that it was sort of about how history was alive in the present. And to me, this connection between the two queens, I mean, there was sort of not a stronger way that you could hope for that would illustrate that.
It is quite amazing because in the bet, this man, Timothy Mayer, said, if I don't come back in an hour, burn the ship to destroy the evidence. And of course, the ship was burned and everybody jumped off. And here are these people who you are filming, who were their descendants. It's extraordinary.
It is. It was. And the other thing that's extraordinary about it to me is even in Mobile, people don't really know this history of this ship. It's kind of been erased. It's an invisible history. And so I'm hoping that now it won't be quite so invisible.
So here you have a Mardi Gras where the white queen is descended from this historical character, slave owner and clearly proponent of slavery, and then the black kings and queens are descended from the people on the ship.
Well, the black queen, not the king.
Right,
the
okay,
queen.
Right. And there was, as recently as 1981, a lynching in Mobile, which you talk about in the film. What do the attitudes between these two groups look like now? I mean, it's after slavery, after Jim Crow, but, you know, just at the beginning of the Obama era. What does it feel like in Mobile between these groups?
I mean, like I said before, I think there's curiosity, there's fear of the unknown, I think. I mean, one thing I'm hoping will happen with the film is that, people just start talking about, because I think it's very hard, and not just in Mobile, but just in this country, for people to talk about race. I mean, I've shown the film now all over the country. I've traveled with it a lot. And, I don't think this is isolated, certainly not in Mobile. I mean, I'm from there, so I was able to make this film. And I felt like Mardi Gras would be a very interesting way to sort of explore kind of what's going on in our country with race right now. But I certainly don't think it's limited to, a group of Southerners. People have been able to relate to this wherever we go. But I do think, at least in Mobile, I can't speak for the whole South, but these things are kind of, it's sort of more taken for granted that things are separate. I think that people just sort of accept it in Mobile that things are like this, and they don't really question it. And hopefully, when people look at the film, they'll start to maybe question it some.
Well, it's a wonderful film for, I think, fostering discussions. I watched it with a friend yesterday, and we had a long discussion afterwards about some of the themes brought up in the film. And one of the questions that the film really brings up is, should these two different Mardi Gras be integrated or not? And I have a friend who is from Selma, Alabama, and she's in her 60s right now, so she lived through the whole Martin Luther King period and everything, and she was telling me once, she said to me, you know, Mary Charlotte, I am not in favor of segregation, but segregation worked for me. I was a star in my high school, I was the homecoming queen, I was in the top of my class, and in an integrated school, I wouldn't have been anybody. And I was thinking about that conversation when I was watching this film, because both of these Mardi Gras celebrations are really different in their cultural expressions, that one wonders what either of them would become if you tried consciously to mix them.
Well, I just think it's interesting that she thinks she wouldn't have been anything if she'd have been integrated. I mean, sort of what does that say about her attitude?
I think it was a realistic attitude. I mean, I think that in her element, and it was, you know, when I was watching your film, there was this moment where the black king and queen are welcomed by the white king and queen in a moment of wonderful pageantry, and they kind of looked a little bit nervous and out of their element.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that these things are very uncomfortable, you know, always, because it's been separate for so long. But one thing I've noticed as the people who are in the film, Stephanie, the black queen, and Joseph, the black king, and Helen Mayer, the white queen, and Britton, who is one of the members of the court, Dor Finley, who is an activist in the black community and a historian who speaks in the film, we've all traveled together throughout the United States and also to Europe representing the film. And one thing I've seen is that, you know, as these people become friends, things that I thought before, you know, might not change seem possible. I think, I just feel like, you know, maybe these two groups won't merge, but who's to say that, like, other groups that start up might have a different tradition, you know? I mean, I think a lot of this is about power and keeping power in the hands of a few families or, you know, in certain parts. It's not just about race, it's also about class, and I think if you kind of look at it that way, I don't know. I think it's a very complicated question, but I don't know if I agree with your friend saying she wouldn't have been a star. I mean, you know, certainly it would have been harder because it would have been an era when things were just beginning or hadn't been desegregated. But, I mean, I think things have to start somewhere.
We're talking to Margaret Brown, director of the film The Order of Myths, which opens this Friday, December 12th at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. So tell us about the title of the film, The Order of Myths.
The Order of Myths is an organization. It's the oldest parading organization in the country, and it's an image. The image of the Order of Myths is folly chasing death around the broken column of the South, and it's an image that I bet every kid in Mobile kind of grows up. It's the last sort of, the Order of Myths is the last parade of Mardi Gras because they're the oldest organization. And I always knew that image was going to be like a fundamental image in the film because there's something primal about it. It's something that's like sort of, I mean, it's above like all, it's really about life and death. It's about sort of, you know, partying or enjoying life basically until you die, that dance. And I thought, that image was something I wanted to sort of definitely be prominent in the film. But also in Mobile, this image is kind of racially loaded as well because the guys that there's a traditional way that it's always been where they ask young black men to carry these torches that now they don't use anymore because they're, you know, from, you know, they're not electric. They're they're like braziers to sort of, to go with this float through the streets of Mobile. So, again, it's like sort of this image is sort of racially complicated.
There's this sense, I mean, they call these different groups, these different societies, mystic societies, and there's this sort of sense of mysticism that I didn't really know how to interpret, didn't know how to understand. How do you see it?
Do you mean the secret, like, how do I see what, the secret groups?
What does it mean to be a mystic society?
A mystic society means that there's groups of men or women who like when they're in the group, they can't reveal their identity, which is why in the film a lot of the people who are talking are wearing masks and they're talking because you're not, and people take it pretty seriously in Mobile. The older people take it a lot more seriously. It's kind of not as serious in, like, you know, people my age, but for the most part, but you're not supposed to reveal what organization you're in. So there are these masks that throughout the film a lot of people are wearing.
So have you shown this film in Mobile?
Yeah, we showed the film in July in the biggest theater in Mobile, like 2,000 people sold out house. And I was, you know, pretty apprehensive about the screening, but it went really well. We got a standing ovation. And, you know, there were a few people that walked out, and there was lots of, it was sort of one of those, you know, screenings where people are talking to the movie the whole time.
Really?
It was great.
So what kind of feedback did you get from people afterwards?
Well, we had a Q&A with the people who were in the film afterward on stage, and that was pretty tame. But then the next day, there's this, you know, in the paper, there's this thing called Sound Off, where you can call in anonymously and say whatever you want. And there were some pretty interesting comments in Sound Off for the next few weeks about the film and how it was stirring up trouble and how I was stirring up trouble. But no one said that at the screening. They were afraid to say it to, you know, our faces.
Was it white people saying that you were stirring up trouble, or black, or
I
both?
Think so, yeah, but it's hard to know because it's just people can call in anonymously.
And so have you taken it to other southern cities? I mean, it seems that the strength of it is, I mean, besides it's a wonderful film to watch, but is the conversation afterwards.
Yes. Right, I agree. Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't know starting the film what it was, the connection between the two queens, so I kind of didn't know what it was really going to end up being about. But I am really happy that now, knowing what it is, that it is something that starts conversations, and, I've seen it do that. Helen Mayer, the white queen, like, showed the film in New Orleans, I think a few weeks ago, and, you know, I've been to it with the film in Nashville. It showed in Memphis. It showed in Birmingham. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely getting around to some of the southern cities. Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I can't really remember all of them.
Margaret Brown is the director of the film The Order of Myths. It opens this Friday, December 12th at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. Now to welcome Richard Camp. He is the director of eTech International. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
eTech International, an interesting group that does projects in third world countries, and the tech is about basically technical assistance. Tell us about this organization.
Well, eTech provides on behalf of people in poor countries and often in very impoverished and isolated communities the tools to deal with the technical and often very harsh impacts, environmental impacts, of major industrialization projects, oil, gas, refineries, mines, smelters. And
so basically, if somebody is living in South America, the Amazon rainforest, somewhere like that, and there is an oil drill, there's oil drilling, and they are compromised, you actually come in and help them?
Yeah, we work at the request of communities, mostly in South America, but more recently in Africa also. And on behalf of other groups, they can be environmental groups, they can be groups like Oxfam, that work internationally on a combination of human rights and environmental issues, natural resource issues. And what we tend to do is try and deal with the nuts and bolts problems that are on the ground that people have no information on. So if you have a massive oil gas project or a large mine, this can be new, this can be old. It's rare that you have campaigns that are dealing with these types of issues that also have, you know, the real technical information on what the impacts of these projects are.
Actually go there with measurement equipment,
yes,
and provide data.
Well, it depends. You know, it depends on the financing. It depends on what you can do. You adjust what you can do to the budget and to the situation. We work some places that are, you know, dangerous. Most places that are in poor, relatively corrupt countries. And in the end, we try and provide as much information as possible. If we're able to go and take, you know, today we just had a geologist returning from northern Peru from the Corrientes region, where he's actually been doing sampling of oil cleanups from Occidental Petroleum. And, you know, we're awaiting those results to be able to measure what he's seen with his eyes. In other cases, we're looking at the mining impacts in Guatemala of, you know, a mine that's been very controversial and has led to death threats and a lot of fighting within the community. And we're trying to develop a means, long-term means, to do monitoring that can be accepted by a bunch of parties from, you know, theoretically the mine. That's on behalf of, you know, we have some help from Oxfam America, some from the Catholic Church, and some from a U.S. foundation. So it varies a lot. Generally, you're dealing with very poor conditions, but you're trying to keep in mind, I mean, the perspective of this is that we're looking for practical political solutions, but we're trying to be what you might call, we're trying to do skeptical technical due diligence, okay? If you were a bank, you know, you'd be calling
on skeptical technical due diligence.
Yeah, you'd be calling on a consultant, and that consultant would almost automatically be trying to provide you information that's going to be favorable to a project. This is true of a company too.
So if you have a situation where people where there was a mine and then there's also sorts of toxicity that's affecting a community, in order for there to be a political response about that, there has to be data about who's being harmed, how much parts per million there is in the drinking water, that kind of thing?
In many respects, yes. And the difference is that what you tend to get are several types of technical reports. You'll get white papers. Somebody will come in and say, this is the problem. And then that's it. Second, you're going to have what's going to show up in an environmental impact statement or assessment for a government that is done generally by the company and their non-skeptical consulting firm. And the third thing you're going to have, and this is the most common, you're going to hear from a non-governmental organization and their allies, they're going to be protesting horrible things that are going on. And what you're going to lack, usually, is the willingness. I think as far as I know, we're unique, and we're trying to make alliances with as many groups, governments, and agencies as we can. We're trying to come in there, look at what the problem is. What are people getting affected by? What are the politics? What's the reality of this country? What's the reality of this town? You know, in Guatemala, the military has shifted from killing Indians to moving drugs. You know, what are the dangers that people face? And on top of that, what are the parts per million of water, of air? What are they breathing? What are the health problems showing up? How do you monitor long term? How do you get something going? Where can you actually get some traction to solve a problem that exists or to prevent problems? For example, in the case of oil gas, we're working with the MacArthur Foundation and a lot of groups in Peru to try and work on both monitoring of existing problems. It's one I just mentioned in northern Peru in the Corrientes region. The Camisea Natural Gas Project, where we're trying to develop independent monitoring, any kind of environmental monitoring.
That's in Peru.
That's in Peru still. And in the past, we were able to get enough information internally from company sources to predict where a pipeline that was less than 2 years old would break six times, and it did. But third, we're also trying to look at the best oil gas practices where President Garcia, previously, you know, convicted of embezzlement, president again, is giving away the Amazon and many other areas, giving away oil concessions and mining concessions. So in Peru, where can you get best practices where companies can drill from 20 miles away, extended reach drilling, instead of entering into an indigenous or a reserve or other protected area? I mean, those are examples of, you know, trying to deal with the reality and trying to prevent future realities where, you know, you can't fight the fact that these concessions may have been given away, which is another front.
Now, you have, in that example, a leader of a country who is giving away the country. You have oil companies who are very powerful and have all the science and technical and engineering personnel that they could possibly want. And then you've got you, Richard Camp of E-Tech International, showing up with, a ruler and,
No, I think here's the main thing that we're skipping. Who is E-Tech? E-Tech right now is three principles. I'm a guy who's coordinating stuff. I'm not a scientist. I'm not an engineer. I've got an incredibly fine scientist, Ann Mace, who's an aqueous geochemist, and Bill Powers, who's a utility engineer. We, in turn, when we do get the money, have other really great consultants who we bring in. For example, our geologist, Mark Quarles, who came back from Corrientes today on MacArthur money. Other times, we will be looking for any people that, say, World Wildlife already have in the field. Or we'll be going to the Dutch right. government, with whom we have an alliance from their environmental commission that is part of their government, and we'll try and get them to intervene. We'll promote their intervention. We'll try and look at whatever's practical. So it's usually not Dick Camp with a ruler. If we're going to do it...
I was exaggerating.
No, but it's a really good example because, you know, we are basically... Our infrastructure is very simple. And we maintain day jobs. As you know, I'm a reporter on the side. And, you know, we all try and ensure that if we're going to do something, we're doing it with the type of credibility that could match any peer review from anybody, academic, government, industry.
So you have very accurate reports, but nevertheless, you are up against, in terms of the not so much the science, but the politics, you're up against some very strong forces. Who are your allies? Are they all international non-government organizations such as Oxfam International?
It's been a real mix. In Guatemala, we certainly hope that in addition to the Catholic Church, which is a very controversial type of an ally, that we will have a weak government that we can help carefully strengthen. It's walking on kind of scary eggshells there. We don't yet know what's going to be the most useful thing to do. So, for example, in the case of Guatemala, I can't tell you any more than I can tell funders. In the case of Peru, we've got enough of a track record. We've been in headlines in the paper. We've been controversial enough that by trying to bring together government agencies, there's, for example, an ombudsman, a human rights ombudsman. We're trying to get them.
What is an ombudsman? I just learned that not too long ago.
An ombudsman is, you know, can be in a college. It can be somebody who helps students deal with the administration.
But it's
in Latin America, it's a mediation type of function, but it's basically representing usually those people that are being affected by something rather than those people that are perpetrating something.
Right.
So, you know, it's in Peru, the projects really differ with what we're doing. In one case, we're representing the Achuar Indians. This is the Corrientes area and their cleanup.
And what is it that they're cleaning up again?
They're cleaning up, 40 years of Occidental Petroleum dumping oil and oil gas wastes on their territory. And, you know, we helped develop the plan in cooperation with Plus Petrol, which has taken over as the current, you know, Latin American oil company, to clean up. Now, you know, this is a complex process, but there the allies are, you know, the government's glad to see this maybe taken care of. I think Occidental was really delighted to have the opportunity to walk away from massive lawsuits or international courts of law. It really changes. In Ecuador, where we've worked on, the Chevron dumping case and the leftover from Texaco's operations in the northeast of Ecuador, well, we now have a sympathetic government. Rafael Correa has, been a thoughtful, educated, often ally, whereas before, 10 years ago, I think if we had entered into it, we would have met hostility.
Right.
So it varies. If we work in Bolivia, where there's no money, but we've had requests, I don't know where Evo Morales comes down on all this stuff, Socialists aren't always the best environmentalists.
We're talking to Richard Camp, director of ETEC International. So what about local activist groups in the areas that are affected? Are they well organized? Do you work with them?
In the case of the Indians in North Peru, yes. In the case of other areas, it's been rare. We always work with everybody. I mean, the irony of this is we began this around 9/11 when the stock market was crashing then too and things were in chaos. And we realized if we were going to start a nonprofit, there were three of us with about 70 years experience working internationally in nonprofits, that we damn well better be cooperating with as many people as possible. We can't be competing for limited funds. And that's how we've worked, and that's why we've succeeded, is that, we've We don't always follow the advice of what everybody thinks, but we consult a lot with everybody who is being affected by or working on these projects. You know, we take note of where they're fighting with each other, because nonprofits and third world countries always try and kill each other. So, you know, our role, I think, is to try and provide something that seems like it can work under the circumstances. That limits a lot of what you do.
How does it limit what you do?
Well, aside from the fact that money isn't there frequently, you feel like, okay, if there's a whole lot of struggle going around among different forces in civil society itself, and, you know, we're just going to be viewed with suspicion, let's just ride this out and wait. We're not straining at the bit to take new projects. It's generally been that we get a lot of requests. We spend a lot of time, usually unpaid, trying to figure out what to do with it. And then we try and see if we can get funding to work with it. And currently, you know, we're funded to be working in Peru and in Guatemala and in several areas in Peru and to do assessments. Probably the most interesting one to compare to the U.S. is Ann Mace, who's one of my partners in this, did a study for a group called Earthworks in the United States that looked at U.S. mines on federal lands that under the process called NEPA, where if you're going to be approved under federal land, you have to demonstrate you're not going to pollute in the United States, Forest Service, anything else, BLM. And she and an associate did a study that showed that 73% of all U.S. mines approved since the late 1980s, new mines, violated the Clean Water Act.
Right.
Oxfam essentially has, you know, given us a grant to be looking at this globally. And two mines in absolutely impoverished, the poorest people imaginable in Mali and Ghana, gold mines there, as well as the Yanacocha, a giant mine that Ann's worked on in Peru, and the Marlin mine. We're trying to look at what they said they would do, and whatever available information we can get shows did they pollute or didn't they, and what information is available, and what can people get their hands on, and how can they get any kind of response.
So in these very poor countries, and it turns out that the gap between what they said they would do and what they did do is a very large gap.
Generally.
Then the next step is?
The next step is going to vary by each country. In Peru, there's a very well-organized civil society. And there would be responses.
With a more than semi-functional justice system?
That's a good question, because the justice system in Peru has been monstrous. I don't know. It was definitely a step up from where it was, but not functional, a couple of years ago. And I haven't been involved in any justice, you know, any legal cases there. Ecuador, for example, that remains to be seen.
But when you say that they have a civil society, what
is civil society?
No, how does that help actions to be taken when you've got this gap between how much they were supposed to pollute, which was not at all, and how much they did?
The one thing you do have in Latin America, for example, and I can't answer a lot of questions about Africa. We worked in Nigeria, but it's still a bit foreign, is squeaky wheels.
Right.
El grito, the scream, you know, brings
the more you complain,
response.
The more
you complain,
there is.
The more you can complain, you know, in Peru it's very easy to get access to the press. It's very easy off for us also to get access to the press in the United States. So, you know, in the case of a larger issue like the mine in Peru we're looking at, you know, based on what we do, if we do have noteworthy information, we can get an audience. And groups can get a response from government because this is a major issue in Peru. Now, what do you get in Guatemala? I don't know. I think that, you know, in Guatemala, it's as if we're entering the first stage. Nobody's really done this in Guatemala. It's new to have any serious industrial development. It's even newer to have any response that's anything other than, you know, fear and hatred. You know, it's an area in which genocide still forms the way people respond, which is to presume that, you know, the people who are there that they're fighting would kill them. And the death threats are rampant. So, I mean, what is it that they will get? I don't know. And I think we'll enter into this, you know, carefully.
Another thing that you are working on is low-carbon alternatives for San Diego and Tijuana, the border area there. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that project.
Well, that's an outgrowth of a group that several of us were involved in previously called the Border Power Plant Working Group and a project with the San Diego Foundation, which is like the San Diego Community Foundation. In that particular project, ETEC, through Bill Powers, who's the utility engineer, has developed very, very concrete recommendations on how to proceed to apply solar, how to apply greatly improved distributed generation, local generation of electricity through photovoltaics, through discrete electrical generation projects, and dealing also with the movement back and forth that's going on with San Diego utilities and some of their allied companies to develop power on the Mexican side in Tijuana and to try and avoid more power lines and in its stead increase generation in San Diego by up to 40% of renewables by the year 2020. And to make this, again, a type of project that requires, you know, a public response. Is this real or is this not? And to date, you know, that the response, which was first very angry by some of the larger privately owned utilities and very positive by the government of San Diego and Tijuana, has been, you know, we may be missing a few pieces of the equation, but I think the report is extremely well put together. And, you know, again, how much of this can be implemented or will be implemented may depend on a mix of, you know, Barack Obama and California, Schwarzenegger, and public and private money. That's obviously a very different, you know, milieu, medium to be working in terms of the politics.
What is the nature of the relationship between Tijuana and San Diego? Do they communicate well now? He was shaking his head.
It's the communications have long gone on, and I have 30 years of involvement in border, you know, mano a mano, shake hands, clap everybody on the back. I think the problem with Tijuana is, you know, there's a very high murder rate and a lot of drugs and narcos running things. The question of whether you can get, you know, alternative energy into this equation effectively, there's a very, very effective, very strong, very brilliant group of non-governmental organizations and individuals that are working out of Tijuana. I mean, really amazing people. And they've been at it for 25 years. So in terms of access to government versus access to money, they've got that. They've got the ear of the government. They've got cross-border communications. And the potential there is probably higher than anywhere else because you have so many brilliant minds working on this. And you've got California where, you know, you're going to have cutting-edge mistakes in trying to get alternative energy in
cutting
place.
Cutting-edge mistakes.
But you're going to also have cutting-edge policies. And that's a long other conversation.
So what else would you like to let, we've got about 2 minutes left, people know about ETEC International, besides the fact that they can be found on the web at etecinternational.org?
Which is a bit behind on some of the projects. I'll try and get it updated in the next month. I think for those who are seriously interested in providing technical support, we had one volunteer person in Santa Fe contact us already. We're interested in getting people who want to volunteer time because our budget is marginal. And
you get grants from foundations, and that is going down.
We never really
knows.
Got you know substantial grants from foundations until the stock market started to crash. And there's still some of the, you know, we have 3 years of commitments in Peru for $50,000 a year, and you can do the math on that. We are definitely open to donations from individuals. I know that there's very few foundations that fund international activities that are likely to be in the radio audience.
But if they are,
and if you're an individual and you're interested in supporting our work, I'm happy to talk with you and meet with you. Call me on my cell. That's the best number.
Which is?
670-1337. That number again.
670-1337.
Because I'm on the road a lot. And you can also reach me. My email's terrible, so I'm going to give you an alternative email, which is Camp Richard, K-A-M-P, Richard, at yahoo.com.
All right.
You can email me there. And, you know, we can certainly use any support. I mean, everything we have goes towards our programmatic work. That's not the best way to run a nonprofit. But I think
well, but you also
earlier,
don't have big fancy offices with
no,
fancy
we have,
furniture.
We have people use their individual offices. I use a tiny office behind my house.
Yeah.
We have separate offices that are being utilized in Boulder, Colorado, and San Diego, California.
Well, I want to extend to you my admiration for the amazing work you do, and thank you for being on the Radio Cafe, Richard Camp.
Well, thanks a lot, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here again.
And we will see you soon.
Take care.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Suzanne Chambers from Open Hands and artist Bill Jackson. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
So we haven't had Open Hands on the air for a while. Open Hands is kind of an institution in Santa Fe. What's it all about?
Oh, absolutely, Mary Charlotte. Open Hands has been in Santa Fe for over 30 years, and we serve about 10,000 New Mexicans every year. We primarily work with the elderly and disabled, and we provide programs that help them live with dignity and independence. We have a medical equipment loan bank, our adult day service, and we also have our home safety program, as well as our thrift store, which is right over at 851 San Mateo.
So the thrift store serves to fund the other things?
Absolutely. We also have one other service, too, that some people in the community don't know about. We have a job shop, which is a handyman service, and that provides handyman services to anybody in the community for a small fee, and the proceeds also help fund our other programs.
So that's a lot of things. Let's talk about them a little bit one by one. Medical equipment loan bank, is that what you said?
That's correct. The way that works is that anybody in the community can borrow assistive equipment such as wheelchairs, crutches. There's absolutely no fee for this service. And they can just go to our offices at 2976 Rodeo Park Drive East and borrow it for a two-month period.
And what, I mean, these are people who are presumably not covered by insurance that would otherwise give them those things that they need.
Absolutely. You know, for some people that don't fall under that criteria, or maybe they just need it for a short amount of time so they can come on over and they are just welcome to borrow it. And again, it's no charge.
Now, the handyman service, that's also something that's extremely important for people who are either disabled or elderly or just not very handy, who've got problems.
Like me. No, absolutely. That's another thing. It's available to anybody in the community. The proceeds help fund our other programs. And it's a great resource for people of any age. We can help them in terms of some weatherization. Again, there is a fee, but that service is available too.
And there was another program that you also mentioned.
Oh, sure. We do a lot of things, Mary Charlotte. We have
where are my notes?
We have our adult day service.
That's
which
right.
Is where caregivers can bring in their loved ones to be watched during the day. Those, it's for primarily people suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's. And we also have our home safety program.
So it's daycare basically for adults who really would be a danger to themselves if you left them home alone?
Very much so. And it's a great help for caregivers to really give them a break during the day.
So how do you, I mean, you don't do any of those things yourself. You're more the communications person, but that's challenging work.
Very much so. And we have just a tremendous caring staff in our adult day service program, and they provide wonderful activities. They have art therapy. They have pet therapy. So it's not like you're just, you know, they're having to be by themselves and be isolated. This is very much a service for both the loved one and for the caregiver.
Pet therapy meaning people get to hold little dogs and cats and things like that?
Yes. And we do that just a couple times a month, and they love it. So it's just a great resource.
How do you reach out to people to let them know about the services that Open Hands provides?
Well, we do it through a number of different ways. Certainly, we have a limited marketing budget, and things like this are wonderful. But another thing that we do often is that we have a lot of community outreach and other fundraising events, and which is one reason, too, why we have Bill here. This upcoming weekend, we're having something very spectacular happen. We've had 144 Santa Fe artists donate their works for a special fundraiser to help fund our programs. And that's going to be tomorrow, December 12th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Nussbaumer Fine Art Gallery, which is 314 South Guadalupe. And then the following evening, the first night is a reception. People can come in, meet these wonderful artists that have helped us so much. the next evening on the 13th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Nussbaumer Gallery. They can come and actually bid on the works, and there's going to be hors d'oeuvres and entertainment, and it's just going to be a lovely time. And I kind of like Bill to let you know how he got involved with this.
Please do. Bill Jackson.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. About 3 years ago, an artist friend of mine, Bonnie Teitelbaum, had a really unique event happen in her life. Her 87-year-old mother-in-law came to visit her to spend the winter, spend 6 months with her. Her mother-in-law's name was Hannah, and Hannah was an Alzheimer's patient. And Bonnie was having a hard time wondering how she could handle Hannah's illness. And she discovered Open Hands. She realized that Hannah needed constant attention. And she discovered Open Hands, and the Open Hands van would arrive at 10 o'clock in the morning and pick up Hannah and involve her in the adult daycare program that Suzanne was just telling you about. And then bring her back a little after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And Bonnie was so relieved and impressed and overwhelmed by this, how well this program worked, that she wanted to give something back. And she's a member of an artist group called The Artist's Voice, which was started about 5 years ago and now comprises 120 local artists who mentor each other and work together to help each other along the pathway towards becoming an artist and developing their careers. And Bonnie brought it up to the group, let's do an auction. Let's create an auction, a silent auction. Let's create art for this auction. So a year ago, we did that. And I think there were 103 artists last year, and we raised $25,000 for Open Hands. And Suzanne was telling you about this year's auction. Each artist has created a 12-inch by 12-inch original panel painting. There are some sculptures. When you have 144 artists, you have such diversity you can't imagine.
Well, I love those exhibitions, and one has them in Santa Fe from time to time where everybody gets the same size starting point to work with, and then the diversity that comes out of it is unbelievable.
The other thing that's really unique about this event is it's a collaboration between galleries and artists. And in a sense, I think there's an authenticity about it. The galleries provide... through their sponsorship, the money that pays for the panels. So every artist is working on exactly the same piece of panel or canvas. We have emerging artists. We have professional artists that are gallery associated. We have artists with very advanced careers. So we have all ranges of artistic endeavor.
And so the preview is tomorrow night, Friday night, from 5 to 7 at the Nussbaumer Gallery at 314 South Guadalupe Street. And then the silent auction is the next night from 6 to 9 in the evening.
That's correct. And if anybody would like some more information, they're welcome to call our offices at 505-428-2320. Or they can also go on our website, which is www.openhands.org.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being here. Suzanne Chambers, who is with Open Hands, and Bill Jackson, who's an artist. And it is quite a fine thrift store you've got there as well.
Absolutely.
And if people want to donate to it?
They can stop by. The hours are 10 to 5, Tuesday through Saturday, and they're welcome just to go ahead. It always helps to call first if they can. Let us know before they donate, but we really appreciate that.
Well, we want to thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks so much to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features the classical jazz quartet performing Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.